The Thousand Oaks Ecclesial Study Day, entitled Zechariah's Night Visions. Our speaker is Jim Stiles, and we'll turn it over to him now.
Well, we got through all the hard part in the first class. It was all that historical background, you know, all that boring stuff back then. Now we get into the good stuff on the night visions, and we only have six visions to do in three classes, so that's just two a class, so piece of cake, right? All right. I couldn't see skipping the background, because really to understand what's happening in Zechariah, we have to appreciate the background. And you have to have the setting straight before you realize what a tough job it would be to go in there and convince people to get back to work. There were a lot of reasons why folks were sitting around saying, we're not interested, we don't want to get to work, and they didn't want to do it. So, and it also helps us then understand, when we're going through Zechariah now, we're looking at the visions, we want to look at them from the perspective of how would that have motivated you to get back to work in ecclesial life. How would that have done that to you? And what that vision is supposed to do then is give us the same message today. What motivated those people to get back to work then is the same thing that will keep us going today, those of you working right now, and those that aren't working, if you know, sort of slacked off over the last few years, this is what will motivate us to get going back again in ecclesial life. And I find Zechariah's message is really good for that. And that's what I'd really like everybody to take home from this weekend. It's one of those times where you come together, we have a little study day, and we stir each other up, literally. We let the Bible stir ourselves up, and we get going again in ecclesial life. Everybody needs those recharges of the batteries once in a while, and the pep talks and all that kind of stuff. And that's a little bit about what this weekend's about. So we got to somewhere in there. Where do we get to? Step one, the mission. Step one, and you start looking in Zechariah chapter 1. And that's what we'll take off for the second class. In Zechariah chapter 1, at the very beginning, the very first thing that Zechariah comes back in is that, look, he sets the basis. If we're going to have an impact on these people, then Zechariah gets the message right from the beginning that everybody has to come back to Yahweh. We've got to be willing to come back. God can't work with people who are not looking for a way back to Him. If we've wandered away and we've gotten out of the work, first step is return to me, he says in Zechariah chapter 1. That was that first section that Brad was reading in verse 3. Thus says the Lord of hosts, return to me, says the Lord of hosts, and I will return to you. And you could see how that would come across to people who realized that he had stopped the work. He'd stopped it. He'd sent a king who came in there at that period there and just said, you can't work anymore. But if you return to me, I'll return back to you. Actually, that same message had been delivered back before in Jeremiah chapter 3. It was the same consistent message that had come along. And the reason that's key to Bible mark those verses in Jeremiah is because that was the message in Jeremiah 3 and in Jeremiah 4 and in Jeremiah 24. That was the message God had delivered before they were taken captive. And his warning is, you might think you're back in the land right now, you 40-some thousand that have come back. And you might think that 70-year captivity was just your captivity, but don't you think I won't do it again. If you don't return to me, that captivity, what happened to your fathers back then, it's all going to happen again. So that's the way Zechariah starts his message. It's a warning. It's a realistic wake-up call that either we get back to work or God might just pull us out of the land again. It's quoted later on in Malachi chapter 3 with the same message. You know, and here Malachi, right at the end of the Old Testament, the warning was still there. If you don't take this seriously and return back to me, then you think about that captivity and whether you want to go again. And they did. The Jews went back into captivity again. You look at, our God really, he is faithful, and he won't fail us, but he has to have us on board. God can't do it all. Angels can't do it all. They're willing to work with us, but we've got to make some good decisions in our lives and return back to him. You look in Zechariah chapter 1 at verse 4. Like, your fathers, you know, where were they in Zechariah 1 and verse 4? Don't be like your fathers, whom the former prophets had preached, saying, turn now from your evil ways. His warning to them was they've got to give up these evil ways. That's actually taken from 2 Kings 17, when God explained why he had to remove the northern kingdom out of their land. So these were like little clues that he was feeding through Zechariah to the people that, you think back, that northern kingdom, I warned them back then and told them, if you don't return back to me and turn from your evil ways, you're going away captive. The Assyrians came in, they took them away. You know, and the warning, the same one that Jeremiah had delivered, if you don't return to me, you're going away captive. So the warning at this point in time that Zechariah starts out with a good, humbling, realistic wake-up call is, Think back a few years to our ancestors. They got the same warnings. And if they didn't return to God, then he was going to carry them away captive. And he did. And the captivity could come again. So you look at the response of the people. You look at how they respond here in Zechariah chapter 1 from this first little vision that Zechariah had seen. In Zechariah chapter 1 at verse 6, and when he delivered this and he let them know that, what I said, it happened, it did overtake your fathers. So the people respond halfway through verse 6. They returned and they said, just as Yahweh of hosts is determined to do to us according to our ways and according to our deeds, so he has dealt with us. You're right. He did. He warned us. He said this is what was going to happen. And he did it. He did it in the captivity, that God was right. And so now the people admit they've made their mistakes. Now they're ready to acknowledge that God has dealt with them according to their sins, according to the ways that they were acting. And now there is a basis for moving forward. And so we get the first vision. Everybody's on the same page. We realize that God was right. This could happen again. If we don't change our ways, we're going to go right back where we had started in the captivity. And so now he gives them in one night these six night visions that come across, and he tries to get them motivated to get working again in God's temple. Actually, there are seven of them. Hopefully we'll look at all seven. So in chapter 1, when Brad read through that in verse 7, on the 24th day of the 11th month, look at the vision in chapter 1, the very first vision. Here's what he sees. And I copied these out of some notes that Brother Bart Bartholomew did, because I looked in our Christadelphian writings. I didn't find very often that anybody drew any pictures of these visions. I even searched all over the internet for pictures on Zechariah. I didn't really find much at all on Zechariah. If we have any good artists in the community, see, that would be a really good talent if we got some people that can draw. Got some drawers out there, some of the younger kids in the audience that can draw. Draw some of these pictures, you see, and turn them in, and we could collect pictures of the visions. So if we ever give this again, I'll have some better colored pictures for you. But that's the basic idea. It's always nice to have some pictures. The first vision. So what he sees in the first vision in verse 8 there, we saw that he sees a red horse. And there's a man riding on the red horse. And it's standing among these myrtle trees, or these myrtle bushes that were out there. And behind him were these horses. They were red and sorrel and white. And probably they had riders on them as well. Now, you look at the background, you can see this is what Zechariah saw, and it's pretty clear what happened when you look at what he saw. But what had they done? What had these horses been doing? And you find that he asks that question. He says in verse 9, well, what are these? And the angel who talked with me said, I'll show you what they are. And the man who stood among the myrtle trees, so now the man who was on the horse, standing amongst the myrtle trees that was there, he responds. The man who stood among the myrtle trees said, these are the ones whom the Lord has sent to walk to and fro throughout the earth. And they answered the angel of the Lord, so here's this angel that's there riding on a horse who stood among the myrtle trees, and they said, we have walked to and fro throughout the earth, and behold, all the earth is resting quietly. Now, look at that within the context of the problem. That some of the Jews were saying, this isn't the right time. We can't build a temple now. The political times are bad. Is it now Darius Hystaspes had taken over. He'd only been in power for just over a year. And as soon as Gomedes had come in, as Pseudo-Smyrnus, areas around the empire were rebelling. As soon as they realized he was a fake king, everybody who wanted to tried to split off from the kingdom at that point. And we know in the historical writings that Darius Hystaspes spent at least 2 years bringing the empire under control. And see, what God had done is he'd sent his angels out on their horses, patrolling the earth, and he'd given them a job. He said, you got to take care of this problem over here. These fellows over in the east side of the Persian Empire, they're rebelling. And he sends somebody else out. He said, we take care of this problem down here in the south. Egypt's ready to rebel again. You take care of this problem over there on the west. And the Lycians were rebelling at that point. And all these angels had been out bringing the world back under control, involved in the politics of their times, and they would come back and they give their report, coming back on their horses, and here's the vision that he sees. The angels have returned, and they say, all the earth is back resting quietly. It's all back under control. It's time to get working again. And this is how he was going to deliver this message. So that's what you see happening here in the vision. And you can see the reason for the vision, of the first vision in Zechariah, this first one, is God wanted to let you see a little window into what he's doing behind the scenes. Here's Haggai out there telling the people all the things that they'd been doing and why it was wrong. And in Zechariah, he lets a little window into how God sees it. God had sent his angels out patrolling the earth. They'd been working now for a couple of years in Darius' kingdom, and they brought the kingdom back under control, and everything was at rest. And now they're ready to go. There's no excuses in it for anymore as to why we can't continue the work. So that's what they'd been doing. You look at the vision of the horses among these myrtle trees. You think back, you know, the horses, the colored horses. You know, in Revelation, you make your studies in Revelation, we know the colored horses had to do with, like, different ways in which the empire was being treated, whether it was a time of peace and righteousness, whether it was a time of war and bloodshed. And most of our writers, and I think they're right on this, is that these colored horses are used to represent the power that God has to enforce his war and his famine and his pestilence and the different ways in which he can work in the empire, the mechanisms that the angels have of working in these political powers, and eventually sometimes even to bring peace throughout the world. And you'll see the horses used that way again later on in Zechariah 6, and you can see them in Revelation 6 as well as Revelation 19. So the angels had been out there accomplishing their jobs, bringing the world under control, using their tools of famine and war and pestilence all throughout the empire, just as they had used the economic troubles, the famine, as Haggai brings out, in Israel. They brought Israel in times of famine right now to try to convince the people that, look, all this work you're doing, I can just blow it all away. The myrtle trees. When you look at why would these horses be standing amongst the myrtle trees? Well, when you look right through the Bible, you find the myrtle trees are used as an example of the idea of like stability and peace and endurance. You look at some of the cases where they're used, the myrtle trees. You get the feeling sometimes looking at pictures that the myrtle trees are like big giant trees like oaks, and they have hanging branches, and the angel rode in underneath the branches, and that's where he was on the horse. That isn't it at all. When you look at the myrtle trees, I was surprised to find this out over there in Israel. They're actually more like a bush. They really aren't a tree, and most people all say they really should be called a myrtle bush. And when you look at the key characteristics of these myrtle bushes, the reason they'll grow in the Middle East area is because they can survive periods of severe drought and in times where there's hardly any water at all. They're extremely drought resistant, and yet they stay evergreen all the time. And you think, over the 70 years, why bring these horsemen back and having them stand amongst the myrtle trees representing Israel? Was that God was presenting them as being there amongst the Israelite community in which God had kept evergreen, and over the 70 years he had kept them drought resistant. They were still able to withstand all the things that had happened in the political world and the empire in that whole 70 years because he was going to keep them going. And that's the first vision that you see with the angels standing there amongst the myrtle trees. Now, what about the horsemen? When you look at like who they are, you look in verse 10 of chapter 1, it's pretty clear that he responds back, "These are the ones whom Yahweh has sent to walk to and fro throughout the earth." That was their job. You find out in chapter 4, these horsemen are going to come up again, only they're presented in chapter 4 as being seven eyes. And they're seven eyes that are like looking at a stone. And they're fixed on this stone. And he tells you later on that these seven eyes are the eyes of the Lord which scan to and fro throughout the whole earth. And as you're going through Zechariah, it's going to become very clear that one of the consistent the themes that Zechariah is going to bring out is that the angels are there constantly working behind the scenes. We just can't see them. But we know they're there, and he's trying to encourage the people of his time that these angels, God's eyes that are running to and fro throughout the earth, you don't see them. They're here right now. They're involved in your life, your family life, your ecclesial life, and they're controlling the events of this world. They're out there riding their horses around, in a sense, and controlling the political powers and setting things up all throughout the earth. What have the angels been doing? When you look back at what the angels had been doing in Ezra chapter 4, it's a fun study. We don't really have time for today, but in Ezra chapter 4, when you go back and watch what the angels had done, the angels had brought the whole kingdom under control. And, you know, in terms of these adversaries that had been, like, coming against the Jews, the angels had totally suppressed the adversaries at this point so that they could not stop the Jews from working. Even though the adversaries, in Ezra chapter 5, they came around, they started collecting names of all the people that are out there building and say, "What's your name?" And they write down, you know, "Your name." And they, "What's your name?" And they're writing down all the leaders of Israel. And they're going to go ready and they're going to present this to the king. And they're going to say, "Look, with the intimidation that they were using, we got this brother, this fellow, this fellow, this fellow." They make this whole list and they send this list of names up to the king. And they tried to get the king to stop the work. And the Jews appealed and they said, "Well, look, you know, all we're doing is what Cyrus told us to do." And you remember the appeal was made? And Darius goes and he checks the writings and they find an Ekbanetet, an actual copy of the scroll up in the summer Persian summer houses up there. They found a copy of Cyrus's decree, and that's what turned the tide. And you can imagine how the angels were involved in that. They were making sure that all this was happening behind the scenes so that the work could go on and the adversaries of Ezra 4 were just totally shut down at this point. They put down the rebellions throughout the Persian Empire over this period of Gomedes' reign, and they brought the earth back to resting quietly. The angels had done all this behind the scenes. And our problem is we just don't see them. We don't realize how enthusiastic they are, how much they care about us, working behind those scenes so that we can get on with the work. And it's a perspective that we'd all be a little bit better off if we realized how much the angels have helped us out this past week and all over the times. When you look at in Ezra chapter 5, if you ever go through that section there, when you look at how the angels had brought about the peace and security for the Jews right now as they'd been out bringing all the world to rest, the response that comes back from the king, from King Darius at this point, is he says, look, all you adversaries, you stay far away from there. Stay away from these Jews and leave them alone. Let the work on this house of God alone. Let them keep doing the job. And, really, of all things, who would have ever expected God would open a window like this? He says, and besides all that, you pay for it. Now, and imagine how that would have gone over to these adversaries. God had done far more for these people than they even dreamed was possible. He'd opened up this window of bringing in a new king just like this and said, look, if you'll get back to work, if you'll trust me, I'll take care of all the things you need and make sure the work gets done. So the adversaries of Ezra 4, in the end, they end up paying to finish the temple. And whatever else they need, the king says at that point, let it be given to them day by day without fail. Whatever they need, we want this temple finished and built, and in 4 years it's done. And it was such a turnaround of events at this period, all apart because of what Haggai and Zechariah had convinced the people to believe that God will do it. Now, you look in Zechariah chapter 1. I find this fascinating when you're reading through this chapter to watch the flow of the events, how God tried to get the people back to work, remind them about the captivity before, and it could happen again. He gives them a vision that says, look, the angels have been out there working, they've ridden back now, and they brought all the work, all the world under control so that we can get back to working. And they've been doing all this behind the scenes. You didn't realize this was happening. And now in chapter 1 at verse 12, an angel of Yahweh answers and said, and the angel, he's talking to God, he's saying, look, how long will you not have mercy on Jerusalem? You know, you might think we got people in ecclesial life that are working against us. We got people in heaven, angels that are out there working, and they're talking to God saying, how long are you going to wait? How long is it going to be before the kingdom comes? All these things that we've been working for 6,000 years, how long are you going to wait? And they're excited. They're enthused in heaven about what's coming in the next few years. And they're just so excited about it, they can't wait for it all to happen. And so the response that comes back when God answers the angel in verse 14, so the angel of the Lord spoke with me and said, proclaim, saying, thus says Yahweh of armies. And you'll notice how Yahweh of hosts is in Zechariah. It's one of the most commonly occurring phrases of any of the other prophets. And you can see why. These people were scared stiff. They thought these adversaries were going to come after again. The Persian king was going to shut them down. And they needed to be reminded that Yahweh of armies was out there working for them. They had angels out there working for them. They had no idea what was out there. It was like when Elisha had said, open the eyes of that young man and let him see. Let him see. And there's a window into what's happening behind the scenes. That God has tremendous zeal for Jerusalem in verse 14 and for Zion with great zeal. And you see in verse 15, he was angry with the nations. He's angry with those nations that had been working against them, that had suppressed the building at this time. And for I was a little angry and they helped with evil intent. And now in verse 16, you see he's returning back to Jerusalem. In verse 16, he will show mercy to these people and my house will be built in it, says Yahweh of armies again, Yahweh of hosts, and the surveyor's line is going to be stretched out over Jerusalem. It's going to get done and be rebuilt as long as you all are on board. I'll take care of that. You just get out there and do the work, and all those workers I have behind the scenes, they'll take care of all the problems that you can't do. And that's the way it is in life, isn't it, brothers and sisters? When you look at this in terms of like what it means to, if you had been living back then, you had to have the faith and believe that if I get out and do the work, if I get involved in the ecclesia now and go out there and do the work, that God has promised he's going to bless the efforts. He'll protect us. He'll take care of the economics. He'll take care of all those things that we get worried about from time to time. He promised that he would take care of all those other things if we would just get out and do the work. Just get involved and do what you can. You know, lift what you can. Bring whatever you can to ecclesial life and do it. Don't sit around and think about all the reasons why all the time isn't right. Oh, I can't do this. I've got to work at home. I've got to get that bank account up. I've got to, you know, go out on this and that. Just get involved in ecclesial life and do it, and he'll take care of the work because he wants to choose Jerusalem. Now, of course, the lessons for us. You know, I find when by looking at the historical application of Zechariah as opposed to like all the future applications, and it's fun to look at the future because we know the future application is coming when the kingdom will be built and we hope to be a part of it, and it gives us encouragement and enthusiasm. But when you look at the historical applications, you can see the lessons for today. You know, God is just as involved today in our ecclesias and our families as he was back then. We just can't see it. It takes that eye of faith to believe that those angels went with you this morning in the car. The angels go home with you. They're here now. They'll go with you to your job. They go with you to school. They go with you everywhere. And they're working and working and working to try to provide a vehicle for us and a pathway for us to walk through his kingdom. And we hold those seminars and we get involved in Sunday school. We take on jobs in ecclesial life and we try to do our best. And the angels are there behind the scenes. They're there to help us out because they want us to make it. It's just as they wanted us to get finished at that time. You see that you get that vision and pictured in your head of these angels just asking God, how long are you going to wait until you have mercy on these people? And that's the kind of appeal that the angels have that are working with us today. They stay involved, even in the tough times. Even as the ecclesia was going downhill and people were getting discouraged and they didn't want to get the work done, the angels are still there pulling for us behind the scenes. They really want us to be successful. And when we get discouraged, we've got to remember that the angels are on our side and they're enthusiastically involved. They care. They want you to make it. And you've got people that are like moms, like those angels. You know, it's like the moms with their children. They're out like rooting on the sidelines for their kids and they wanted to make it. The angels are doing for that. They're doing that for us all the time. They work with us day after day and they want us to make it through the troubles and the problems that we experience. And they're hoping for our spiritual success. And it's always good to remember that God sends them to help us because he loves us. And he's zealous for us to grow, and he wants us to develop in his family, just as he's choosing Jerusalem back here. And he's wanting his house to go up. He wants you to be a part of his spiritual house. He cares. He loves you. And he sent out his family, his angels, to make sure that we will make it into his spiritual house. That's the kind of God that we have, and it's a God who has a tremendous amount of love for us. In the next vision, at the end of Zechariah chapter 1, after first of all, he's encouraged them that he will definitely work with them. The angels have been out there working, and now all the world is ready to go. He sees another vision, and you can imagine why this one came up. Here's the second vision. And Zechariah sees four horns, maybe coming from like the four different directions. And he sees the four craftsmen, or the four carpenters. Now, what ends up happening is that the horns had scattered and humiliated Israel. And you could see why this would happen. If you were in Zechariah's shoes and you tried to encourage these people to get back to work, one of the first things you would have to face is the discouraged, depressing side of ecclesial life that would come to you and say, well, we tried to do this before, but all these people put us down. The adversary, all those Samaritans, they were writing letters against us. They were hiring people to come in and cause us trouble. These people were working against us and we couldn't get the work done. And these four horns had been terrifying the Jews. And they had scattered them, and they'd caused all this trouble, and they focused in on all the things that had been depressing them over that time. And so he sees a vision that's going to encourage people to get beyond this stumbling block. How are we going to get beyond this point where all we could look through, go back over the last 20 years of our life and realize, look at all the trouble we've had to face. Look at all the problems that came into our life. Every time we tried to get working, it always got stopped, and we had to face all this trouble. So you look at the four horns in Zechariah chapter 1, you think, well, what are they? We know that horns represent kings. That comes up clearly in Daniel, Revelation, all over the place. We got the horns representing kings. So you try to figure out, well, who could they have been? And you look back over four kings who were really responsible for scattering Israel and really splitting them up over the last 100 and some years of Israel's history. And we definitely got Shalmaneser back in 2 Kings 18, who took part of the northern kingdom captive. You can go back and look at Sennacherib back in 2 Kings 18, that he came in as well and carried away some of the people. We've got definitely Pharaoh Necho, who comes up from the south back when he killed Josiah and came up from the south, and then later on he took some of the people captive with him on down to Egypt. And then you've got Nebuchadnezzar, who had carried the Judah and all the rest of them up there over that period of 20 years and carried them away captive. So Israel had been getting hit over the last 100 years or so, and especially by the Babylonians. They had been hit really hard on people from the south, people from the north, coming in and taking their kingdom apart and scattering them and terrifying them. Now, it may be that the four horns represent that. Or it's also possible that the four horns might just refer to the adversaries in a general way, like in the four directions that all around you, all these adversaries that have been coming against you in your lifetime over the last 20 years, all these Samaritans that have been causing you trouble, and the political powers that had made you stop, all of these people that have terrified you, it's the end of them all. I'm going to shut them down. So what he sees next is four carpenters. So against the four horns now, we have four carpenters who come along, or four craftsmen or smiths, whatever you've got in your version. They're called the craftsmen in some of the versions, carpenters in the King James. You look at what these fellows do. These carpenters, that word that's used for carpenters, really what it means is a smith. And a bit on context, you have to look at what kind of smith it was. You can see that it's used of a blacksmith in 1 Samuel 13, back in the time when the Jews weren't allowed to make swords or spears. But it's also used in Ezra chapter 3. And I think that's worth Bible marking. This word was used in Ezra chapter 3 when they delivered all the money over to the people and got the carpenters and the builders going on building the temple. And I think what's happening in this vision is God's trying to show them that, yes, you can see in a depressed way all these four horns that have caused you all this trouble. Well, I'm going to use you. The carpenters, the ones that are the builders. I'm going to use you, and I'm going to empower you to where you're going to terrify those horns. They're not going to beat you. You're going to beat them, and you're going to overcome them. I'm going to empower you to do that. And he did that with the decree of Ezra chapter 5. And he gave the Jews the authority to build, and you could even ask all them to pay for it. And you can imagine how that would have gone over. And Zechariah had made the prediction ahead of time, if you only believe, if you only believe and get back to work, I'll take care of that. And in Ezra chapter 4, or in 5, you could see how if you lived back then, you would start to see, wow, that's just what he said. He said he'd use us. We'd terrify those adversaries around us. And now look at, they're not allowed to stop the work. They can't even bother us. And they even got to pay for it. And that's exactly what God said he would do. And the four carpenters then were empowered so that they could overcome their adversaries and finish this temple. But you had to believe. You had to believe ahead of time God was going to carry it out. And he did. He brought it to pass. And you look back in the history of nations that have been told ahead of time, that God had predicted back in Deuteronomy 2. You can see in Deuteronomy 11, these are just passages where God had predicted ahead of time that if you believe me when you go in the land, I promise you that I will put the fear of you on the other nations. And that's what he had predicted. The one in Joshua is the same way. Remember with Rahab, when the fear of the Jews had fallen on Rahab. But you look at the one in Esther chapter 6, and just note that one for a minute. Because Esther fits into our time period right now. Do you remember what happened when Haman, when they found out that Haman was working against Mordecai? And Haman was going to prepare that day, had his gallows all set, and he was going to try to destroy Mordecai. Haman comes along a couple of years after the temple's finished. And you see, God had said, if you only believe, I'll make sure I put the fear of you on these nations, and this house will be finished, and nations will start coming to you and be drawn to you, and I'll put the fear of you on all those people. You realize that up in that empire right now, that message was going out when this temple was finished. And they knew, when Zeresh's wife, when she found out that Mordecai was a Jew, and she said to Haman, look, if Mordecai, the horn of you begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you won't prevail against him. Because the message had been going out to the empire that Yahweh, the God of the Jews, was blessing his people. And you better not work against Yahweh. And see, this was all like a type of the kingdom. This was happening back then. It was really happening, as it will happen again in the future. These people experienced a time period in which they trusted God, built his house, and the fear of them went out over the nations, and Gentiles were coming to Jerusalem to worship Yahweh of hosts in Jerusalem. And it actually did happen. A forerunner of the kingdom age. And see, that's the benefit of looking at the historical application here in Zechariah. This all happened back then. It's all hidden in the Bible a little bit. You've got to search for it here and there. Now, because I don't know how to use PowerPoint real well and copy slides, that was actually down to class 1. And I couldn't figure out how to copy all class 2 into class 1. without losing all the backgrounds for class two. So I'm just going to go back and start it over, if that's all right. And see, now we're on to class two. I knew class one was going to be too long, but that's okay. Really, my goal this weekend is just to share with you what I've discovered and found on Zechariah, which has been a lot of fun for me, and to give you some kind of a basis for looking at these historical applications. And you can always go through the PowerPoints on your own if you get copies of them, and you just go back and look, or you can look at some of our writings that have done the same thing. But it is exciting to see that initial time and picture yourself living back then and find out that would that have stirred you up or wouldn't it? Would that have motivated you to get going? And that's the same message that we're hearing today. And it's supposed to stir us up. We've got to get working in God's house as these people did back then. So at the end of chapter 1 now, what we have is that you've got this vision of the four horns that have been terrifying all of you. And what God does is just pulls the rug out right under every Christadelphian that ever said, well, we can't do this, we can't do that, we can't do this because it didn't work for 20 years. It hasn't worked all. And God says, look, believe me, get back to work in ecclesial life and I will let you, through you, I will overcome all those problems. And I'll take care of all the big stuff that you can't do. Just believe. Like Joshua going in the land. We'll take care of the big stuff. We'll get rid of all the big cities and take care of all the fortified cities. And I'll give you the whole land. All you got to do is believe and go out there and take your inheritance. Just believe. I'll take care of all the big things that you can't do. And that's what he's done with the Lord Jesus Christ. He's taking care of all the big things. And he's just asked us to do our part. So in chapter 2 of Zechariah, now we get another vision. Here comes the next one. We're on to vision number 3. And he raises his eyes and he looked, and behold, a man with a measuring line. This is the vision of the measuring line. Now, you consider the situation with this measuring line. There's only about 40,000 Jews back in the land right now that we know of, 40,000 men that are listed in Ezra chapter 2 that are back in the land. Only 40,000 of them. The adversaries had discouraged and troubled and hired counselors against these people, and these adversaries had been working against them, and they had actually managed to stop the temple. The Persian king had actually demanded that the work stop. And what had happened is that now, if we're going to get back to work, if we're ever going to get this project done, what people were thinking back then was that we've got to get these walls up. We need protection. It's not even safe to go through Jerusalem right now. The adversaries have been causing all kinds of problems, intimidating the people. You know that passage in Zechariah 8 about God showed them, in Zechariah 8, we'll look at it tomorrow in the exhortation, how the day is going to come, if you believe, when children will be playing in the streets of Jerusalem, and the old men will be there and the old women in the streets of Jerusalem. That's because they couldn't do that right now. They were scared for their lives of what had happened to them over the last couple of years. And they didn't have that freedom. And God promises them that, look, if you'll just believe, I'll take care of those things for you. And he presents the picture of the day in which your children will be safe again. We'll have safe areas where they can come. But not because you built walls. Because I'll take care of you. And I'll make sure it's safe. So you look back over this period and you can see why these people would have been worrying about protection and thinking about the walls. And so he shows them a vision as you follow through this. And you look at what happens in this vision is this man goes out and he's all excited. He's going to measure Jerusalem now. He's got the measuring line. We're going to measure this side. We're going to measure this side. And he's measuring the city to build the walls because this is what the people would be thinking. So it's almost like the Apostle Paul anticipating the questions of the Judaizers in the New Testament. God gives a vision anticipating what these people are going to tell Zechariah that, we don't need to finish the temple. We need to build the walls. And so right up front, he says, look, you don't need the walls. I'll take care of you. And that's what this vision was about. So the angel goes out, and he talks with another angel going out, and he says, run and speak to that young man. Stop him. This young man is going to measure Jerusalem for these walls. And he says, look, you tell that man, Jerusalem's going to be inhabited as a town without walls because of the multitude of men and the livestock in it. For I, says the Lord, will be a wall of fire around her, and I'll be her glory in her midst. Now, you see, that would be really important to lay that out right from the beginning. You don't need to worry about building these walls. I'm going to take care of the walls. I'll be the wall of fire around you. I'll be your protection. And he did. He did it through the Persian government. And he set up and said, look, adversaries, can't touch these people. Whatever they need, give it to them. Whatever they need to build this temple, and he will protect. That was his promise back here, and it was actually fulfilled in Ezra chapter 5. So this is all happening at the beginning of Ezra 5. And then in Ezra 5, what you get is finally he gives us the detail of how it was all worked out. So immediately, see, after the, well, when you look at why Jerusalem doesn't need the walls, you can see why. He's going to bless the city with a lot of people and a lot of animals, and God's going to be the wall of fire around the city. That was his promise. But if you had been living back then, brothers and sisters, and kids, the young people, if you had been living back then, would you have had the faith to believe? Would you believe he would really do that? And then you read through Ezra 5, it reads so easy. We see the trouble of Ezra 4, and then we read chapter 5, and oh, everything's all better now. They had to respond first and get back to work before Ezra 5 would ever happen. And that was the job of Zechariah and Haggai, to stir these people up, to get back to working in ecclesial life, so that Ezra 5 could actually happen. And the angels are all sitting there waiting. Can we do it? Can we do it? Just waiting for what they could do. And they had to wait for the response of the people. God is not going to force these things on us. He's going to provide all the vehicles we need, all the help that we need to get work done in ecclesial life. But he isn't going to force us to get to work. That's something that has to come within us. We have to be stirred up by these prophets that are going to encourage us to get involved and take that step of faith and get involved in ecclesial life. Get involved in a project. Volunteer for a seminar. Do something and working in the CYCs with the young people. Get involved in the ecclesia. Visit the sick. Do what we can in ecclesial life, everything we possibly can, and God will take care of all those big things that we can't do ourselves. So that would have required a lot of faith on these people. Now, in the midst of all this, you might wonder, in Zechariah chapter 2, verses 7 through the end of the chapter, there is this message that goes out. Look at Zechariah 2. This is not really part of the visions, but it's a follow-up on the vision. Up, Zion, escape you who dwell with the daughter of Babylon. For thus says the Lord of hosts, he sent me after glory to the nations which plunder you, for he who touches you touches the apple of his eye. And he gives them this assurance that for surely I will shake my hand against them, and they shall become spoil for their servants, and then you will know that Yahweh of hosts has sent me. So as soon as the warning is there that God will protect the city, and he intends to fill the city with people and animals, the message goes up to Babylon and says, hey, all you Jews that are back in Babylon, all my people back there, get out while you can. Flee Babylon, get out of there, because I am choosing Jerusalem now. Don't stay up there. Come on back down to the land, because I am going to protect the land. I'm going to be the wall of fire. My glory will be there with you now in the land. All that we had seen in Ezekiel of the glory coming down and picking up the glory in those first 11 chapters of Ezekiel and leaving the city, God was now returning to the land. And he wanted all of his people to get that message. So now Zechariah's message was not only for the people in Israel, to get them stirred up and get them working, it was the warning to all the rest that had stayed in Babylon, get out! Come on down! And that's what happens. You see the Ezra's coming down later on. As soon as the temple is finished, Ezra chapter 5 and 6, Ezra comes back in chapter 6, and he brings a whole bunch of people back down. This message, they heard it. They heard the message, and they got out, and some of the people at least got out of Babylon at that time, and they came back on down. And so that was his warning to the people, is to get out of there. Come on down while you can, because he's going to shake his hand against the nations, and he will protect his people in Israel. And he predicts that many nations will be joined to the Lord at this time, if you'll only believe, and he will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Now, convincing these Jews to return was not real easy. And we might think it would be really simple. You just put out a decree. Cyrus makes a decree. Only 42,000 went back. That wasn't a whole lot. And you might wonder, well, why? Why didn't they go back? When you look back in Ezra chapter 2, that was a bit frustrating, that out of all the Jews that were up in the land at that time, really, we might think 42,000 is a lot, but you get 42,000 in a stadium, you know, one football event or something, and 42,000 people will watch that. I bet there'll be more than that in the stadium tomorrow in that Super Bowl. Out of those 42,000, look at, only 74 were Levites. 74 Levites. These were the people that they were counting on to teach the community the truth. And only 74 Levites were willing to come back. That's sad, Ezra chapter 2. You go on and look at when Ezra finally does come back. In Ezra chapter 8, when the temple is finished and he finally brings the people back with him, and he gets permission from the king to come back and beautify the temple, he has trouble convincing any Levites to come back. He gets all these people together up by the river Habit, assembles them all down there, and then they take a head count amongst the people and find, well, how many Levites do we have? And they look around and find, We don't have any. Nobody who knew the Bible was willing to come back and teach these people. That was not a very easy time to convince these people to come back. And so Zechariah's message was going up there. Look, God will choose Jerusalem. Get out of Babylon and come on back down. But it was a tough message to deliver. The people didn't want to come. You look at why, when you look at the trip, that was not an easy trip to make, that trip from Babylon. You're looking at people that lived up in this area. You might look at Babylon right there, and you see Israel over here, and you think, oh, no problem. That was like on the way here. You know, we looked and we said, well, the halls, the building we're going to is right over there. It's right over those mountains, you see. And that's not real easy to get there sometimes when it's on the other side. This was all desert area in here, and so you had to follow up the Euphrates River. And they think of what happened with the first trip with Jeshua and Zerubbabel. They went all the way up here and came on down through the land, sort of like Abraham did when he stayed up in here and then came down this way. That was actually a longer way, but it's a safer way because it was a safer way and it was also more food and water that trip. They think that Ezra actually took the short route right in through here when he came on back. It was a dangerous journey, and it was like 400 to 600 miles. That was not an easy trip. So, you wonder, like, why did they have trouble convincing the people to come back? It was not an easy trip to make. No nice cars and all this kind of stuff and airplanes. And it was a rough journey to come on back. So why didn't these Jews want to return? Well, it's a lot easier to stay in Persia. They'd been up there 70 years, and they settled into the land. Especially, you see, the Levites. Why would the Levites settle in so well? They were the educated amongst the Jews. They were the ones who knew, and they were in demand amongst those up in the Persian Empire, and they had gotten themselves into really nice, cushy jobs. They had nice homes up there, and they just decided, we don't want to make that trip. Why would we want to go back down to the land of Israel? Who's going to take care of us down there? We're going to count on these people down there who don't have any, they don't have any houses, really. They don't have any farms that are built, and those are the people that are going to bring in their tithes, and they're going to support me down there. No thanks, not interested in going. And the Levites stayed back. They didn't want to go down. That would have taken a huge leap of faith to believe that God would take care of you if you went down to the land at this time. Long journey, 400 or 600 miles, depending on which way you go. The land was in a mess, run down now for 70 years, and all the trouble that was there. There wasn't much food down there, and it was that God had said, if you believe, I'm going to bless you from this day forward. But you got to believe. He had sent a drought. And the reports that they heard back was the land had gone through a drought and things were bad down there. But his promise in Haggai 1 and Haggai 2 was from this day forward, from the day they began working on the walls, working on the temple again, he said, from this day forward, I will bless you and help you out economically and give you enough food. And the Levites didn't trust these people to support them. So I can see why it would have been trouble convincing some of these Levites to come back, and the people decided to stay up in Babylon. Because that's faith. That's what faith is, brothers and sisters. You ever ask for a definition of faith? You young people, you want to know, what is faith? Faith is believing that if we do what God says, if we believe that we do what God says, that He will take care of the big mountains, and He will take care of all the obstacles that we can't see beyond. If we just trust Him and do what He says, He really will take care of us, and He'll save us, and He wants us to be in His kingdom. And those people had to believe in all that trouble that He really did want them. That was not an easy decision to make. Well, when you look at the motivation to return, what he did in Haggai, Haggai's message was he'll promise to bless them economically. You might wonder, well, why is that in Haggai? Because these people needed to hear it. They needed encouragement to know that if we got back to work on the temple, if we get back to working in ecclesial life, God has promised he'll bless us economically. We'll have enough food. We'll have enough money in order to do all this stuff. And who would have ever guessed that the adversaries would end up paying for the temple? These people probably figured they were going to have to pay for it. But he promised he'd take care of their economy and their food. He promised in Zechariah 2 that he'd protect their cities. And that's what he did. He protected them from the adversaries, and they didn't have to worry about their walls. And he promised that he would dwell in their midst. And these were all things that he did. But for the Jews who dragged their feet, you look at this in the historical record, and you try to fit the Ezra, Nehemiah, and the Esther period all together. It's really fun to do that. When you look at the time period of what was going on, because you got to realize this incident with Haman only comes a few years after the temple's finally built. It's only like 2 or 3 years later when it's finally finished. And for all those Jews who stayed up in Babylon and they didn't listen to Zechariah, you realize they were facing annihilation up there in Babylon? And it's God's last, in a sense, a gentle push of those angels to say, look, if you didn't believe me the first time, you didn't believe with Zechariah, you didn't believe the Ezra decree, or the decree of the Persians in Ezra chapter 1, and you didn't listen to the Ezra taking all these people back, and you didn't listen to the message of Zechariah, he warned me, he said, look, you stay up here in Babylon. You may die up here. You got Hamans up here that want to kill you all. And it was his last push to get those Jews out of there. And he gave them that opportunity to leave. But that's the God working behind the scenes, angels working in people's lives in order to convince them to leave Babylon and get down there and get back to work in ecclesial life. It's fun to watch that historical sense in which you work behind the scenes. The prediction in Zechariah 2 is, in verse 11, did you catch that? That many nations shall be joined to the Lord in that day? A prediction about Gentiles? And we sometimes read these passages and we just say, oh, that's the future, that's the kingdom age when Gentiles would be coming to the city of Jerusalem and the kingdom. And some of our writers tend to do that as a community. But did you realize that in Ezra chapter 6 it actually happened? And you got to read carefully in Ezra 6 to actually see what was going on. When they finished the temple, if you believe this message of Zechariah, and God said, look, I'm going to bring my Jews back from Babylon. I'm going to bring Gentiles back with you too. And Jerusalem is going to be the place from which my word will go forth. And Jews and Gentiles will worship together in my land. If you will get back to work. You look at the end of Ezra chapter 6 in verse 15 when they finally finished the temple. The wall in verse 15, that's the wall of the temple was finished. Whoops, we got Nehemiah. Ezra chapter 6. When they finally finished the temple, and where is it? They finished the temple in that little section from 13 to 7 to 18, and they decided to keep the Passover in verse 19 on the 14th day of the first month. And you see what happened is the priests and the Levites had purified themselves. All of them were ritually clean. They slaughtered the Passover lamb for their brethren, right, and the priests and for themselves. And look at verse 21. You got to read this carefully. These are worth underlining. You got a little color for Gentiles and kingdom stuff. Then the children of Israel, who had returned from the captivity, ate together with all who had separated themselves from the filth of the nations of the land in order to seek Yahweh, God of Israel. Who are they? You realize what happened at this time? That was the message that Zeresh, Haman's wife, realized. Yahweh was blessing his people in the land. It was really happening, all these predictions that he had made about getting the temple and bringing in people from all nations. And as these Jews came back from Babylon, and as the Jews were in their land and they were finishing their temple, they were having an impact on the nations around them. People were watching. Your God's doing something for you. Look at this. Look what Yahweh, their God, has done for them. And people from other nations that were living in Canaan separated themselves from the filth of the land and joined themselves to the Jews and kept the Passover with them. Unbelievable! And they kept the Feast of Unleavened Bread for 7 days with joy, for Yahweh had made them joyful and turned the heart of the king of Assyria toward them to strengthen the hands of the work of the house of God, the God of Israel. And these nations were joined to them at that time. It's fun to see those things. That's what he had predicted he would do. And he used them as he uses us today. If we are working in our ecclesias, if we're building God's spiritual house, we're in the seminars, we're in the Sunday schools, we're working in the CYC, we're involved in our ecclesia and everything that's going on, our friends, our neighbors, they find out, what are you doing? And they look at what you're doing. They look at our children and how they're coming up with respect and they respond to God. And they start finding out, well, how did you do that? Well, how does that work? And they get drawn to Yahweh, the God of the Jews. And you could see how that would happen in that day and age. And it happens today too, brothers and sisters. God uses us when we're actively involved in his spiritual house. That's one of the ways that he brings people and draws them. We were just looking with Brother James Mansfield. He did his classes on David, how he was pointing out how one of David's real motivations to get that tabernacle set up in Jerusalem was he wanted to see those things of all the nations coming to Jerusalem and worshiping Yahweh, the God of the Jews. It was that really willingness to extend this beyond just our community to the others that were out there, and it happened here in Zechariah's day. Well, that's the many nations. So when you look at that, I think that's fun to look at back in Ezra chapter 6, and you can see how these people were joined to the God of Israel at that time. You also see that in Zechariah 8, if you're thinking that this is only in Zechariah 2, you're going to see, when you look at this tomorrow in the exhortation, in Zechariah 8, verses 20 to 23, it's the kind of thing you can Bible mark right now, but this had been the prediction all along. If you get the temple built, if you trust me to take care of you, then God says, I'm going to bring many nations are going to be involved. And there's going to be people come back. And they're going to be joined to you, and these Gentiles are going to worship with you in Jerusalem. You see that in verse 21, verse 22. We often use that passage about the kingdom, about how many nations are going to be joined, and 10 men are going to take hold of the robe of a Jew, saying, let us go with you, for we have heard that Yahweh is with you. This happened at this time. These people were drawing Gentiles to their community. In Zechariah 8, the whole chapter has a historical context to it at this time as you read through the chapter. This literally did happen because the people trusted God back in those days. You find the inhabitants in verse 21, they say, let us go with you. They grab hold of the robe of a Jew. And verse 22, many people, strong nations, will come and seek Yahweh of hosts in Jerusalem and pray before the Lord. And it really did happen in Ezra chapter 5, 6, that whole period there, and even beyond. Now, the fourth vision. We look at the fourth vision here in Zechariah. And we'll probably finish up there for right now before lunch. In the fourth vision, here's what he sees. Zechariah sees Joshua and the angel standing before the angel of the Lord. And the angel tells Satan that the Lord will rebuke you. In fact, I got to ask our presiding brother. I can't remember. We were supposed to quit at, was it 11 or 10:45? Maybe I'm overtime. Is it 11? 10:45. Oh, well, too long. I'll tell you what. We'll cover the fourth vision then after lunch. You see, you'll just have to talk about it at lunch, figure it all out, and then we'll go through it real quick. Yeah. Time for lunch. Thank you.